Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called The Skeleton Crew, a conversation with Deborah Halber on the amateurs who are finding the missing and solving cold cases. So now, without any further ado, here are your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Pleased to have with us today science writer and author Deborah Halber. She's written a wonderful book called The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, Deborah, I love the book. I know our listeners are going to love it, too. It's just such a fascinating subject and one that I just don't think anybody else has explored, before now. So it was a great read. I want to start with one of the cases, in part because this is a case that years ago grabbed my attention, and when I was writing my first book, it really was one of the inspirations, both the people involved in it who were trying to solve it and just the circumstances. So could you start us off by telling us about the Lady of the Dunes of Provincetown and how she started you on your journey for your first book?
Yes, Jan. So this really is an extraordinary case. So in 2010, I saw a photo in the Boston Globe of a woman with like long reddish hair and these gorgeous eyes and this kind of enigmatic Mona Lisa smile. And then I realized this wasn't a living person, but a digital reconstruction of what this woman had looked like before she had been brutally murdered in 1974. And the story went on to say that this woman was only known as Lady of the Dunes because she had never been identified. No one had ever been able to figure out who she was, and I just couldn't imagine how that was possible. So like a fiction thriller or an episode of Bones or CSI, all the stories in my book start out with someone turning up dead. But instead of spending the rest of the book or the show working out who done it, these cases are different. You could call them a who was it, where it's the name of the victim and not the perpetrator. That's the puzzle.
Right. That's going to be your starting. You're not going to be able to get very far until you can at least know who you've got as your victim, I guess, is part of what goes on there.
Exactly. So when I Googled Lady of the Dunes, I came across all these other cases and an organization that called itself the Doe Network, which is for Jane and John Doe's.
Right.
And I realized that people, just ordinary people, were actually taking on some of these cold cases, which are just as baffling. They're real-life cases, but they're just as baffling as ones you'd find in a crime novel. Right now I'm reading and loving Gone Girl, and for me, that book and the best kind of mysteries and thrillers have that element of doubt, you know, where you just don't know what's true, what's significant, and that's the same with these cases. Unfortunately, by their very nature, they are so terribly hard to solve, and in fact, some of them may never be solved. But working out how these real-life amateur sleuths are working through some of these puzzles is just fascinating.
Well, you know, one of the problems is defining the problem. And how big is this, the number of unidentified dead in the United States? Do we have any kind of handle on how big that number really is? And I know there's lately been an attempt by the Bureau of Justice Statistics to find out more about it. You know what's going on there and what they've learned and what's the real scope of this problem?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. I think there was a sense for decades that there was a problem. At least some medical examiners, some coroners, you know, knew that they had unidentified human remains, and it was an issue. But I don't think anyone had ever, before the Bureau of Justice Statistics took this on in 2004, I don't think anyone had ever try to assess really what numbers are we talking about here. So when they did a pretty thorough as they could do, because it was the record keeping was not good. The figure, when I saw their study, the first figure I came across was 40,000. And that number just astonished me. You know, I had heard over the years of an individual here or there turning up. There were the handful of cases like Lady of the Dunes, which got a lot of media play. But it was easy to sort of explain away that maybe the occasional case was somebody who was homeless or didn't have a family or didn't want to be found. And, you know, I'm embarrassed to say that that's how I explained that away over the years. So for years, I lived with this sort of ignorance, which, you know, I think was just generally true. But then that number, 40,000 unidentified human remains in the U.S., that just really jarred me. This didn't seem to be like something that I or anyone else could explain away.
It is a huge number.
Well, yeah. I mean, you just think about a city that size, you know, getting wiped out, how people would react, you know. Numbers are part of it, of course, and it's always great to have a measure like that, you know, for people to respond to. But, Doug and I both try to raise awareness about this. There's no uniform training for medical examiners and coroners. There's not even a uniform definition out there for either of those words. There's no uniform set of procedures that are followed nationwide when it comes to reporting information about the unidentified dead. The people who are in those jobs don't always take the same kinds of samples, don't follow a set of protocols. I think one of the things they found in that 2004 study, or it may have been that one or the one that was done about coroners and EMEs offices, found that an awful lot of them never used the what was then the reporting thing before NAMIS came along. The NCIC was where the Doe cases went before then. So there's just been this kind of set of holes in the system. Is anything being done about that at this point?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when that number came out, and it did get a fair amount of public attention when that study was published, I think it started to make people sit up and take notice. And it led to some national funding to use DNA for this purpose and other tools. But I think the NAMIS, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, is really making the most strides in this area. There it is true that there is still no national requirement. It really still varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But hopefully that will change in the near future. But in the meantime, NAMIS has the idea that medical examiners, coroners across the country, law enforcement, that they all have access to one centralized database is huge. It's just something that was just not true for decades. So the submission process at NamUs provides the opportunity for the people to collect and submit biometric information into this one centralized system. And it can be accessed by investigating agencies across the whole nation. As more pieces of these puzzles are available, more identifications actually are occurring. These bits of information that are now in the public realm and they're not sort of stored away in, you know, somebody's filing cabinet or had never made its way into a report to begin with, these pieces of information are now in the public realm. And these are exactly the kinds of clues that these real-life, you know, amateur detectives, that these folks who almost sort of walked off the pages of crime fiction, but these people who have taken on these tasks themselves, that's exactly the kind of data that they're using to try to make these matches.
Well, you know, the Internet, it's no surprise to anybody listening out there that the Internet's kind of changed everything we do in our lives. And one of them is connecting with people from your past, et cetera, whether it's on Facebook or all that stuff. So people are it's a virtual community out there, as we well know, especially as authors who market on it and all that. But everybody does this. Email. I mean, I'm sure you've had the same experience. You've connected with people that you haven't talked to in decades. It just happens, and that's one of the beauties of the Internet, besides all its downside. But you found a cadre of people out there who started using the web and all of its resources to kind of match the missing with the unidentified. In your research and you're looking into these groups, how do these groups get started? What made this happen?
Well, in the early days of the Internet, the late 90s, there were these tools that when you look at them now, they look like ancient cave drawings compared to what's available today. You know, they were difficult to use. You had to have some level of technical ability to even make sense of. They almost looked a bit like code, you know, like straight code. But you know, some people started working with them. There were some services, Yahoo was out there, some services that created free, public, publicly accessible routes to have people connect, compile information, connect, as you say, you know, today it's Facebook, but then it was in its infancy, but people were still managing to connect through these very rudimentary systems, bulletin boards, Usenets. They were all these little budding things out there that allowed people to, from people around the country around the world who had shared interests to find each other. So a handful of people, interestingly, almost at the identical time, started realizing that they could put information up there that would cross state lines, that would compile it all in one place, that would do something that law enforcement jurisdictions didn't do. They would put it in a place where a lot of people could access it, could add to it. And they started taking information from, you know, old-fashioned sources, newspaper archives, microfiche, public records, death notices. They would sometimes actually just scan or copy this information and just put it out there. Or they'd sit there and painstakingly retype it. And the point was that they were getting it all in one place online. And over time, a few of these repositories became quite substantial. And like-minded people started finding one another and joining forces. And those that found them and were interested started trying to put two and two together. So it's just something that evolved over time, and it before the word, you know, the term crowdsourcing was tossed around, it was a method of crowdsourcing. It was a way that people could come together around a shared interest, around a shared passion for trying to do something about these cases, and it was like, if you build it, they will come.
So did it work? Have they been successful?
Well, a handful of them have been remarkably successful, and they've been successful in the most unlikely ways. There's a woman I write about who is looking for her missing ex-husband, and she came across a facial reconstruction of a young man. She knew it wasn't her ex-husband, but there's just something about the picture caught her eye. And so this reconstruction was based on nothing more than pieces of a skull that a dog had dragged out of the Vermont woods. But something about this reconstruction reminded her of her sister. She had an adored sister who happened to be developmentally disabled. But she felt that there was something about the young man's features that resonated with her. And she remembered she'd actually seen another notice on the Doe Network for a missing young man who was developmentally disabled. So she just kept going with it and just trying to see if the two had other aspects in common. And it turned out that she had actually helped identify this young man who had ended up possibly murdered and dumped in the Vermont woods. And she had linked that reconstruction to a case of when he had been missing and his family had been trying to find him. And in another case, a web sleuth was the one to make a match between a man who was missing from Iowa and a head that had been buried in a bucket of cement. Like a man had been decapitated and the head had been plunged into some liquid concrete and it had hardened and it was basically a bucket of concrete that had been dumped at a truck stop. And the law enforcement who found this bucket, did the forensics, had a reconstruction made. Oh, but this process took years. They had just no idea who this could be. But they went through all the steps as the ones that were available to them. They posted on the Doe Network. They had a reconstruction done. And then years later, this web sleuth came upon the reconstruction, and she just went through site after site of missing people until she felt like she saw somebody who could be a match. So she proposed that match, but somehow even this process, again, took months, and her proposed match slipped through the cracks. And then no one saw it. And this process just went on, and there was still this mystery. But amazingly, her suggestion got through to the right member of law enforcement. It was investigated. And it turned out that she had helped provide a body just in the nick of time for a murder trial that was in progress. So without the ID of the body, they might have never gotten a conviction. But it just all fell together just at the exact right time and place. And thanks to her, a jury put a murderer behind bars for life.
That is, I think, there are many fascinating cases in this book, but that one, I will admit, I thought it's just, when you think of all of the things that came together and sort of when they came together, it was a pretty amazing case. The Internet has its blessings and curses, as I sometimes refer to it as the Internet. It has all of us who've been out there realize that there are great things we can all do together, and there are some really destructive things we can do with each other. So what are some of the problems the web sleuths encountered as they sort of matured and things went on?
Well, early on, the web sleuths didn't have a lot of credibility with law enforcement. And this is not surprising. Law enforcement traditionally likes to play things close to the vest. They don't want to make public a lot of aspects of an investigation in progress. They do not share, and they don't necessarily share with one another, and they really don't share with the public. And suddenly, these self-proclaimed web sleuths were popping up and calling and asking what law enforcement considered a lot of nosy questions about cases that these people didn't even have any personal connection to. So initially, there were plenty of unreturned calls, and one of the main stories I tell in my book is the story of Todd Matthews and how he worked toward the identification of a young woman known only as Tent Girl. And he related how he was continually hung up on in early days. The cops eventually even started referring to some of these people as the donuts. And this was, this is not something you have to be persistent to keep on in the face of these challenges. But a lot of these people did. They stuck with it. They, as I mentioned before, kept contributing to the websites that they populated with a lot of useful information. In fact, I had one web sleuth tell me that law enforcement, some of the cops called her and asked her for some of the details. They told her that she had more on her website than they had in their files. So it started to shift. There became a shift, today there are actually, I've talked to at least three or four detectives who say they are all on board. They welcome the help, and one of them has even come to rely on regular web investigative help. They do not. Nobody wants any of these people to go out there knocking on doors themselves, putting themselves in danger. But they welcome the research help. So there has been a shift, but it hasn't. I would not say it has gone 100% by any means. There are still plenty of resistance out there, and there's a long way to go for the citizens to get to a good place with law enforcement where there's a lot of shared trust.
Well, law enforcement officials are by nature a distrusting lot, and so I imagine that those breaking those walls down, and I'm sure it's on an individual basis too. Some police investigators are much more amenable to this than others, and I'm sure you ran into that. You mentioned Todd Matthews. And Tent Girl. You want to tell us a little bit more about that case, because that's a fascinating case.
Yeah, Todd, I would have to say, is probably one of the best known among the web sleuths. His story has gotten a fair bit of attention over the years, and I think mostly because it's such a quintessential story. I had found Todd Matthews when he was already years into working for a website called the Doe Network. He had signed on to that website early on as a volunteer. He was there was some controversy over who were the founders, who owned the site. There was definitely some drama with that site over the years, but when I first encountered him, he was working for it and volunteering his time. And he was one of the first calls I made after I had come across The Lady of the Dunes, and I realized that the Doe Network was out there, that there were so many unidentified people out there. So I got Todd on the phone, and he mentioned that he had made a match once. And the more I found out about the work he had done, the more this story, his story, struck me as the most incredible story, like rags to riches, revenge of the nerds, triumph of the underdog. It was like it was all rolled into one. He was like a 17-year-old factory worker when he became obsessed with a case. This case was so cold, it had happened years before he was even born. It was a they believed at the time it was a young woman, maybe a teenage girl, who had been found wrapped up by the side of the road, wrapped up in something they thought looked like a carnival tent. So she became known pretty quickly as Tent Girl. And again, it was, you know, just like a lot of these cases, they thought she'd be identified pretty fast. But it, you know, months went by and then years went by. And she had never gotten reunited with her name.
Well, we're gonna take a brief break here, and we're going to pick this back up on the other side.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back here after the break on Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. And today's show, again, is entitled The Skeleton Crew, A Conversation with Deborah Halber on the Amateurs, Finding the Missing and Solving Cold Cases. So now, without any further ado, here we go, Jan Burke and Doug Lyle.
Well, welcome back, everyone. And just before the break, Doug had asked Deborah to talk to us about Tint Girl and Todd Matthews. And I want to reassure our listeners that there is so much more to these cases than we're able to give you here in a one-hour show. But just maybe, Deborah, if you could just tell us a little bit more about that case, because it is one of the ones that I think is so amazing.
It is. It has a bunch of really unlikely connections where you just can't believe that some of these things led from point A to point B. So I guess the very beginning story of Tent Girl starts in May 1968. And there's a well driller named Wilbur Riddle, and he happened to be drilling a water well in a tiny town in Kentucky called Sadieville. And he just collected these kind of glass insulators that used to be put on telephone poles. So he was wandering around, taking a break from work, collecting the insulators, and he came across this tent, and this tent that seemed to be wrapped around, it was like a bundled tent, and he poked at it, he was just horrified to find that it actually contained the body of a young woman or a teenage girl, and he was just horrified naturally. And And he actually, and as time went on, I'd mentioned she became known as Tent Girl, but there was no ID. And he got written up in Master Detective as the person who came across Tent Girl. So fast forward years and years later, his daughter, Wilbur's daughter, is attending high school in Livingston, Tennessee. And she meets a guy named Todd Matthews. They are Todd's, I think, a junior. She's a sophomore, and they're dating, and it's Halloween. And she tells Todd about the worst, the ghost story that is closest to her heart, her father's ghost story of finding Tent Girl. And Todd, takes a look at this copy of Master Detective that Wilbur's got, in his, folded up in his pocket. He's got it with him all the time. And Todd reads this story, and he just becomes kind of obsessed. And it's, there are some reasons for that, which I go into in the book, but he really takes on this case as his own. And he spends the next literally decade of his life whenever he can, driving back to Kentucky, looking in archives, making phone calls, calling the medical examiner, going over missing person cases, as I mentioned, getting hung up on by law enforcement. And he really feels like he's got a psychic connection to this young girl, and he just feels like he's got to be the one who will reunite her with her name. And with the advent of the Internet, that is exactly what does happen. He spots on one of these bulletin boards a notice of a woman who's been looking for her long-lost sister, and it says just a few words, last seen in Kentucky, 5'2", dark hair, and he just knows. Somehow he just knows that this is Tent Girl. So the story just has all these twists and turns. It's just the most unlikely series of events.
It is. It's really such an amazing. And you mentioned earlier, I think it's important to mention that not all of law enforcement has shunned this, or people associated with authorities anyway. You tell a great story about, we'll say, what happened when the Clark County Coroner's Office decided that not everything that happened in Vegas should just stay in Vegas. So tell us about how that office used the Internet to help out.
Yes, you can't tell that story without talking about Mike Murphy, who's the coroner of Clark County, Nevada. So Mike
is a great guy.
Yes, Mike is a great guy, really wonderful human being, and quite a colorful character. Not the image that comes to mind when you hear the title coroner. Mike's a pretty slick guy. He's got a shaved head, and he wears these snazzy suits, and he's probably the last man on the planet to still wear real cufflinks. So he's so Mike's a big personality, and but he's also got a really big heart. So when Mike took over as coroner, he realized that Vegas had more than its share of Jane and John Doe's. I think the numbers were up in the hundreds, more than some coroners see in an entire career. And so Mike decided he really wanted to do something about this. So what he decided with the help of one of his staff, his death investigator named Rick Jones, who was a driving force behind this, they decided to post images of so-called facially recognizable victims on the Internet. And you got to remember, this was in, again, relatively early days of the Internet, when things that are on the Internet were just synonymous with being sketchy. So for an elected official to take this move, it was a bold move, and he was risking a lot. And there was a lot of fallout from that. He got a lot of calls right after that happened, but it was a move that led eventually to other states doing the same kind of thing, and it was one of the seminal moments in having the Internet used as a tool for the unidentified.
Well, you mentioned, I had the great pleasure of spending a half a day with Mike over his office, and I tell you, he runs a great ship with great people, and he's just a delightful person.
He is. He really is.
He is. So you earlier had mentioned, you know, Todd Matthews and how he became obsessed with this with the Tent Girl case, and actually was almost the prototype for a lot of this stuff that's going on. In your rummaging around in this world, what do you see draws people to become these amateur sleuths? What motivates them? Who does it best? But, you know, obviously we've talked about Todd, others. What motivates them? What drives them to get involved in this?
Well, Doug, that's the question that I really wrestled with. When I first came upon this world, I realized that there were and are these websites out there that have these images, like some of the ones that Mike initially put up. And these are, you know, this is a disturbing topic, and it's the images can be very you know, realistic and gruesome, and what, you know, I really had to ask myself, what kind of person can stick with this? And when I talk about this subject, a lot of people assume that the only ones out there who are doing this are missing a loved one themselves, because, of course, that would drive anybody to do whatever had to be done to find them. But interestingly, I found that most of the web sleuths do not have a personal stake in it. They may have come across it. They may have come across the Doe Network or NamUs or some of the other sites that are out there because they knew somebody who was searching for somebody, or they knew had a friend or a relative who was involved in a case. So they may have initially come upon the sites that way, but they stuck with it, that they stayed in it themselves, I think primarily for two reasons. One is for the challenge. They just have the kind of minds that are drawn to a puzzle, to a mystery, who they get caught up, like Todd did with Tent Girl, they get caught up in a particular case. They almost adopt a single case as one that something about it just resonates with them, and they just can't let it go. So they feel compelled to stick with it and try and try and try. And then that becomes the flip side of it, which is that they want to, a lot of these people are motivated to help others. They feel like there is just a huge injustice. They feel for the families who they know are suffering every day, not knowing where their loved ones are. So they feel this very deeply, and they are compelled, for I think a combination of those reasons, to stick with it, because the most successful ones out there are putting in a tremendous amount of time and effort, and they are on the web most nights. I mean, they have day jobs, and they're on it when they get home at night. On weekends, it's hard. I've tried it myself, and it is really hard. But they're willing to, you know, go down the back alleys of the internet for clues, and they are willing to run with a lead no matter how probable. So they are the ones who are having the most successes, the ones who are willing to put in the time.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about the Doe Network, and obviously there's others, you know, the Charlie Project and the Porchlight International and stuff like that. And I want to tell all our listeners that we'll have links to all those on the various websites so that you can go there and look. But let's say someone out there is listening to this and says, "Wow, I really want to get involved in this. This is fascinating to me." What should they do? How should they go about getting involved in this? What advice can you give them? And equally important, what would you warn them against?
Yes. Well, now that NamUs is there, and it is slowly being populated, so it is not necessarily absolutely complete. But it is a good resource. But so I guess maybe one of the first things to do would be to sign up for NamUs, which is very easy to do. But also you do have to think about your personal limits and interests. And I guess one of the things I'd say that you might have to do is develop a pretty high tolerance for rejection and for difficult situations. It seems like nobody loves the web sleuths. It seems like the cops don't love them. And it seems like even fellow web sleuths don't really like them very much, because some of these online communities sort of abound with this kind of competitive drama. And a lot of the users use screen names. And once you're out there, you know, hiding behind a screen name, you can say almost anything, and a lot of them do. And it can get challenging out there. And another thing that I think I mentioned before, many of the go-to websites, you know, you dig down deep enough, you get to the level of the facially recognizable images or even the reconstructions. These images can be quite disturbing, and a lot of these sites do have warnings. You know, this, do not click through here unless you are, you know, willing to see something that may really be quite distressing. And, you know, they try to Photoshop out details, but, you know, at some point you really can't gloss over the fact that these people are dead. So,
well, and decomposed remains sometimes,
yes,
too, or
yeah,
remains of people who've been treated with violence. Yeah,
exactly.
It's not something in our sort of sanitized version of death we run across. We're all kind of removed from death, even from, say, where people were 100 years ago.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. So having a strong stomach is a plus.
You mentioned something that I just want to mention again to our listeners. The NAMIS, there's a National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. That's just NAMUS.gov. If you have someone missing in your family or you know someone who's missing, you can also provide the other side of this equation. I was going to ask you, Deborah, have you seen the events that some jurisdictions are holding where they're getting people to, if you have someone missing in your family, to come and swab a cheek. You know, law enforcement will make sure it gets sent in to NAMIS, but there's no cost. You know, you don't have to pay to do that. So if you do have someone missing, if you go up on the site, it'll give you all the instructions on what you need to do from that side of it too. Have to have something to compare it to.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
There is they really are ratcheting up the outreach to collect DNA samples. It's really getting quite much more widespread than it was even a couple of years ago.
Well, I will never forget having someone tell me the story of her son was missing for 10 years. And it turned out that he had actually been found about 3 weeks after he went missing, but he was in the next county over, and the computers they did have computers at the time, but they were really sort of in the 80s, you know, not interconnected on different systems. The counties didn't share information. So NAMIS is really a huge breakthrough in, and you talk about Marcella also, Farrow, and the role she played in all this, getting something started where there's actually one place instead of 2,500 jurisdictions deciding whether or not it's worth their time.
Right. And I should mention that there was, before NAMIS, there is the NCIC, the National Crime Information Center, which was supposed to be the repository for this kind of information, and it is. It does hold a lot of details, but it is only available to law enforcement. There was no, and I think probably still is no, standard requirement about what, if any, information law enforcement has to put into NCIC if they come across unidentified remains. So there were forensic experts who went on, who conducted studies, published studies in the forensic sciences publications about how they tried to gauge the accuracy and the content of NCIC, and they found that it was actually not very effective for this purpose.
Yeah. Well, also a change that's happening with the economic downturns, a lot of jurisdictions are now cremating unclaimed and unidentified remains, and they're doing that to save money and space as well. Do you think that affects whether or not these cases will be solved?
I do. At one time, cremating a body was just a guaranteed dead end for the investigation into a case of lost identity. The clues to the person's identity literally went up in smoke. This was, of course, before the era of DNA, but even back then, some forward-looking departments actually did keep samples, tissue samples, and they were just on the hope that someday someone would invent a technology that would reunite this person with their name, and that is exactly what happened. They, you know, have gone back to old samples and have managed to make identifications that way. But yes, without that forethought, cremation was just a dangerous way to deal with what was going on. And even though the state of forensics, you know, the art of forensics has, you know, obviously improved dramatically, but as forensic anthropologist Emily Craig tells me, it's, you know, it's still not an exact science. There's, you know, you get ranges of heights, and then you get ranges of heights for missing people. She pointed out that in her experience, you might, you know, if a missing woman's family used to constantly see her in high heels, they would misreport her height. There were missing people who have a tattoo. Some of their family members didn't know they had a tattoo, you know, of a snake on the back of their neck or whatever the case may be. So those details didn't make their way into the reports. So it is still a very imprecise science, which is for one reason why we do need all these human eyes on this. It's not something computers can necessarily match. But basically, yes, the more biometrics that are available, the greater the chances for a match.
Well, with the skeleton crew, you've entered another realm of life. Welcome to the neighborhood. You've been a reporter and a science writer and all that, and now you've got this wonderful book out. How are you enjoying this process, and what does it look like from your end, and what plans do you have to get this thing out there?
Well, it definitely has been quite an adventure. In a few ways. First, let me just say that the book publishing world is very different from
anywhere else on earth. Yes.
I think anything else on earth, and certainly different from. I mean, I started out my career as a newspaper reporter, and I was just used to the idea that you're out there, you get your material, you go with what you've got, and you know, within hours, what you've written is out there for public consumption. But
right.
but that's not the way book publishing works. So, I mean, it's been frustrating to me in some ways because I just felt like a lot of the material in my book just felt so compelling, so current, and I just, you know, as the process went on, I worried that it was going to become less, relevant, but I think that's actually not the case. I think it is true that this is a national issue. It is not resolved. The people who are involved in it are fascinating, and that's one of the things that I enjoyed best, really getting out there, meeting these people who are truly, truly unique and wonderful and interesting human beings, and they were just so, I've been so lucky to get to know them. The people in my book, they are so real and honest and quirky and smart and funny, and a lot of them have been through a lot. And because of that, to me, they're just so much more compelling than fictional characters. That's what draws me to nonfiction, and I think that's what will draw people to this book.
Cool.
So, yeah, do you have anything in the works for the future? Or?
Well, I do actually have more stories that didn't make it into the book for one reason or another, and I do continue to hope to continue telling these stories. There are, as you can imagine, from the point of view of people who have experienced this, who have lost a loved one, there is a lot of frustration in the system, and I just hope to bring some of those stories to light in different vehicles, probably magazines or web-based stories. I just want to, now that I'm caught up in this world and now that I know some of these individuals, I want to do as much as I can to bring closure to some of the families who have not yet had closure, whose stories have not come to a tidy ending, or who are still battling to, now that their loved one may have been identified, who are still battling to get justice for the person. Because, you know, not all of these people are victims of crimes, but many of them are. And just the identification is really sometimes just the first step. Unfortunately, a first step that has taken decades to get to, but it's a first step in the investigation, which, as you can imagine, can be quite challenging after so many years have gone by. But there are stories out there. It does happen. They do manage to solve these crimes, even decades down the road. So that's another indication that there's, you know, they should never give up. You should never give up.
Well, thank you, Deborah. That's a great note to end on. Don't give up, but do come back and join us again. You can see more links, more information at crimeandscienceradio.com. We'll have information about Deborah's book and links to some of the sites we've mentioned. And Deborah, thanks so much, and best of luck.
It does, Jan. Thank
book.
You so much.
Yes,
really
thanks
a
for
pleasure.
Being with us.